A Century of Service, presented by the State University of Iowa. This year, the State University of Iowa has reached a landmark in the passage of time. On February 25th, the university became 100 years old. During the past 100 years, the university has passed many landmarks in the discovery of truth, the advancement of knowledge, and their wide dissemination among all the people. Landmarks which culminate in a century of service. This afternoon, the State University of Iowa presents the sixth in the series of programs in commemoration of its 100th birthday. Today's story is told by a senior at the State University of Iowa.
Hello, I'm Patricia Grothaus, a senior in the State University of Iowa. You're probably thinking, 4 years of college, but that's not even half of it. Actually, I spent 19 years in the university. That may sound strange, but let me explain. At age 2, I started out in the class for the littlest students on campus in the Department of Preschools, located in that funny little building next door to the law school. After 3 years of that, I moved over to the 6 floors tall, narrow building known as the University Experimental Schools, where I attended kindergarten, first, second, through all 12 grades. At last, after 15 years, I entered the university itself, once again a freshman. So you see, it is possible to spend 19 years in formal education at Iowa's university. These university schools serve a triple purpose of research, demonstration of modern educational methods, and teacher training. It wasn't until the teens of the 20th century, however, that a really permanent experimental school was established at Iowa. After much urging by Mrs. Clara Bussey Hillis, the state legislature set up the machinery for the Child Welfare Station, and when the station opened, the staff promptly organized the present preschool. Shortly afterward, President Walter Jessup was able to extend the school program to cover the kindergarten, elementary, and high school. Just last Sunday, I was helping some of the 3 and 4 year old youngsters in my Sunday school class put together a robin redbreast jigsaw puzzle. They were having considerable difficulty fitting all the pieces in correct order, and they kept demanding, "Where does this go? Is this part of the redbreast?" I couldn't help remembering a situation back in my own preschool days.
Patsy, come over here. I want you to see something. See, Patsy? This little green box has locks on it, and they fasten the lid down tight. But I'll show you what I have in the box. It's all full of little toys, and they're lying right down flat on the bottom of the box. Let's take out each of the toys, shall we? As I lift each one out, suppose you tell me what it is, Patsy.
Oh, that's a train. And a clock. And a dog. Whoa, whoa, whoa. That's a bird. A mitten. I have a mitten just like that, all red.
I guess that's a little girl.
A little sunbonnet girl. Now, Patsy, you put the blocks back in the box just as quickly as you can, and then fasten the lid. You'll have to lay each toy carefully, all flat on the bottom, or else the lid won't lock. When you get them all put away, you may see the toys I have for you in this other box. You may begin, Patsy.
Does the train belong over here? Is that the right space? I haven't played with this game. 2 more things to put in. That won't close.
You'll have to make a space for every one on the bottom of the box.
I can't. I don't know how to do it. Oh, somebody baby's left out now. Well, I'll do her first at a time. Oh, my gosh, the dog's out now. I don't know how I'm going to get this done, but someday I will. If the train was only that short, it would fit, wouldn't it?
You can get them all in if you try. See how quickly you can get all the blocks laid down on the bottom of the box.
I can't make space for them all. Will you do it? I can't. I don't know how to make spaces. You do it. Let's see what's in this here box.
Not now. When you get the toys laid in and the lid locked, you'll still have time to play with the toys in this other box.
I don't know how. Now there's not enough space for the dog. I'll have to leave that dog out.
The time is almost up, Patsy. You have only a little more time to get all the blocks in the box. See if you can't do it now.
I can't. I have to leave one of them out. You better find some room for that choo-choo train. You better, else Mother won't like you and Peter Rabbit won't either. And I don't like these toys because they won't fit.
Time is up now, Patsy. We'll have to put the box and the blocks away now. You tried hard, Patsy, so I'm going to let you play with this little toy from the box I've been holding.
One could hardly call that excellent behavior on my part. Like many of the other children, I had responded to failure in several unhappy ways. But for Mary Elizabeth Keister, the young woman conducting that experiment, my reactions were quite important, for they helped her to develop a new method of studying personality differences between children. She found a way to tell quickly which children respond in a mature and acceptable manner to failure, and which ones, like myself, haven't learned how to stand up under frustration. But Miss Keister wasn't finished with her experiment. Now she wanted to find out if special training could help a young child to conduct himself more sensibly when he met with failure. To try this plan, she took those of us who were poorly adapted to failure situations and gave us much encouragement and help while we worked with other puzzles. Until by the time we came to building the block boy, which was really the test, we learned to be more persistent and not nearly such whiners. It was like
Patsy,
this.
You're going to build the block boy again today. Now, this won't be easy, you remember, for he's very tall, and if you're not very careful, he may easily topple over. But if he does tumble, that'll just give you another chance to build him up better.
Let's see. It's first the legs from the pink box. How tall is he, Miss Keister?
About 3 feet, Patsy.
That's as tall as me. See, I've got him built up to his blue jacket.
It's too bad he fell, Patsy. But now you've a chance to start over and make him straighter and steadier than before.
If he fell again, then I'd have to make him up again, and he's hard to do. I'm sure having a hard time. But look, this is steadier now. I'm making him better. I think it'll stay this time. No, it's gonna stay, I suppose. See? It's gonna stay! I'm gonna make you gooder, Mr. Blockboy. Nice and even this time.
But Miss Keister's experiment with failure proved successful, and the Child Welfare Station had another star to place on its roster of successful experiments. I discovered that when I mention University Elementary as my grade school, many people are prone to lift their noses slightly and say, progressive education, I know. They seem to have some strange idea that we don't learn our three R's, just spend all our time in some vague form of units which have no earthly connection with reading, writing, and arithmetic. They're quite wrong. For instance, in second grade.
Yesterday, you remember, second grade, we decided to make an Indian teepee of our own. I think we should get started on it right away, don't you? Now, how shall we go about it? Where do you think we should start?
Well, first of all, we got to have poles for it to hold it up.
Yes, Johnny, that's one of the first things. Do you have any suggestions as to where we might find the right kind of poles to suit our purpose?
My dad's got a lot of poles out in the farm. I bet he'd let us use a couple of them.
Do you know just how many we'll need?
No.
You know where to find out, don't you?
Sure. Look it up in the book that we read about teepees in.
Fine, John. I suppose that you should be chairman of a committee to arrange for getting poles for the Indian tent. You choose the boys and girls you want to help you. Patsy, what do you think this committee will have to know so that they'll be certain to have the correct kind of poles when we're ready to use them?
How tall it's going to be? And the kind of tree to get them from. Lots of times the Indians were awful careful about what kind of tree they used to keep their tents up.
How many poles we gotta have?
Uh-huh. Those are some of the requirements. The committee will probably need to make a written list to keep them all in mind. But we can't make a teepee just out of poles.
We've got to have skins for the outside. But our department stores don't have skins like the Indian department store the Buffalo did.
Then what do you suggest that we use?
We might try paper.
That wouldn't last very long.
Well, then how about cloth? Yeah, brown cloth.
I think that's the right suggestion, Kay. Muslin is probably the least expensive material, so we'll be able to get enough of it for our big teepee without spending too much money. But it will be white. Patsy, what are we going to do about that?
Well,
I wonder if any of you boys and girls have ever come home with stains on your clothes. And your mother said, oh, Tommy, that stain's on there for good.
Sure, I have. It's usually grass stain.
And I got berry stain all over my new yellow dress Sunday.
Apparently, most of you know what I mean by stains, then. Can you think of one that's brown?
Coffee?
Certainly. Tea makes a brown stain, too. Maybe you've seen your mother dye lace or cloth brown with coffee or tea. I was wondering if maybe we couldn't use one of those for our teepee.
That's not dark enough.
Oh, you could dip the cloth lots of times.
I'm afraid even so, the color wouldn't be dark enough. Does anyone remember how the Indians made their dyes?
From bark and roots and stuff.
What was used to make brown?
Walnuts, I guess.
Very good, Charlie. You really read that book, didn't you? There's a way of using walnut hulls to make a very deep, rich brown dye that would be just about right for our teepee. Patsy, I'll appoint you to read in this red book the explanation of how to make the dye. And then, Kay and Beverly, I'd like two girls to find out from these books how to use the dye to make the material appear brown and weathered. Then tomorrow, we'll have reports from the girls about the dyeing process. But before we can go much further, before John and his poll committee can operate, we'll have to decide on how big our teepee is to be, where we're going to put it, and so on. Suppose, first of all, we each get out some drawing paper and pencils and crayons and draw pictures of what we think our teepee should be like. Then, from there, we'll be able to decide.
Detailed arrangements were made to secure the most accurately representative teepee possible. We applied our arithmetic in determining proportions and the amount of cloth necessary to cover the raw skeleton. Walnut hulls collected by us in the city park dyed the muslin brown. The teepee on its poles was erected with a proper flap door and smoke hole, and then ample care was given to the appropriate sun, moon, man, and dog decorations in real Indian vegetable paints. Willingly and forcefully, we had applied all the basic and artistic skills. In third grade, motivation was provided through a study of pioneers, and a new series of projects began. In first grade, it had been a farm with a real-life garden. Later years, fourth on, offered opportunities along wider roads, glimpsing museum visits, puppets, dramatizations. In fifth grade, the minuet, and in sixth, a study of American folklore.
And shall we just carelessly allow children to hear any casual tale which may be devised by casual persons and to receive into their minds ideas for the most part the very opposite of those which we wish them to have when they are grown up? We cannot.
The bicolored python rock snake with the scalesome, flailsome tail coiled on the banks of the great, gray, green, greasy Limpopo River all set about with faber trees. The bicolored python rock snake. Mother, what satiable curiosity?
What is what, Patsy?
Satiable curiosity.
Oh, insatiable curiosity.
No, satiable curiosity.
Well, Patsy, that was just Rudyard Kipling's way of saying insatiable curiosity. Or never running out of questions to ask. What made you think of it?
Well, the teacher today said I had satiable curiosity. And then she got down the Just So stories and read us the story about the elephant's child and the bicolored python rock snake with a flailsome, scalesome tail and the...
There, Plato, was an answer. Edwin D. Starbuck's answer to your philosophy. And when in the middle 20s a wealthy philanthropist offered a prize of $20,000 for the best plan of character building, it was Dr. Starbuck, then head of Iowa's philosophy department, who won the award with the Iowa Natural Plan.
Organize the school along the lines of a family or community of society. Allow the pupils to live a normal life in such ways that the native impulses of self-expression, friendliness, and idealism find their natural outlet. Fill the school with art, music, and especially with the choicest of reading materials. Let the teacher be primarily the artist rather than the didactician.
But Dr. Edwin Starbuck was hardly willing to stop with the theory. For what constitutes the good literature, and who knows where to find it? To answer that question, therefore, he established the Institute of Character Research on the campus. Guides to literature were built, and in the university experimental schools, the teachers were making ready applications.
You can't have any of my candy. You can't. There isn't enough.
Charlie, maybe there isn't enough to go around, but you should tell us so nicely. You mustn't be like the little old lady in the black dress, white apron, and red cap.
Oh, the one who was making all the cookies smaller and smaller so they wouldn't be too big to give to the poor man. And so she turned into a red-headed woodpecker.
The very one. Charlie, do you remember when we read that story? Remember when
we noticed... Let's make a summary of all the characteristics that were exaggerated in Paul Bunyan that made him such a typical American character.
John, suppose you start.
Well, he had lots of initiative.
He was friendly, too.
Big guy.